So good evening, Bodhisattvas.
Good evening.
So I remember Joan saying in a talk some time ago now, asking, said, if somebody told you that you could reach out your hand and take hold of a thread that would attach you to any of the everything in the universe, would you hesitate before you took hold of that thread? And then she said, sort of helpfully in Joan's way, well, of course, you're a hold of it already. So we're always in the bath. So we're also always already in the bath already with everybody and everything else, just as they are, as Andrew said last night. But sometimes it's kind of hard to remember that we're in the bath. And so as Megan said, we come to a retreat, we come to Sesshin, and we build a special ritual, temporary, magical container. And in that container, the special container, we can pretend we're entering the bath as if we weren't already in it. We can pretend we're entering a container as if we were not already in it. And there's that serious play of being where we already were and being aware of it in maybe a way that we not always are. So I don't spend a lot of my retreats in the bath with the 16 bodhisattvas, but I spend a lot of time in retreat in the water with water koans. And over the years, that's been a really important part of my practice. So I'm going to talk some more about water stuff tonight. A couple of the koans, I'll just read them again. I won't talk about them tonight, but some of the range of them. The Sea of Ise, right? In the Sea of Ise, 10,000 feet down lies a single stone. I wish to pick up that stone without wetting my hands. And then from Balinghaujen's Three Turning Words, the kind of strange, surprising answer to what is the blown hair sword? What's the sword so sharp that it would cut even a single hair blown against it? The really lovely, each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. And Joan talks about that as the coral sea and its warmth and gentleness. So anyway, for me, in retreats for stretches on end, I'm not really in water, but as Andrew said, I'm in Metaphorlandia, or as Wallace Stevens said, I'm often in that space of resemblance where the space I'm in has something of that water-like quality, and I want to try and evoke some of that. So there's some obvious stuff if you were really in literal water that almost goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. So one thing would be that if you're in water, you can really feel being that you're held up by something buoyant. You know, it's buoying you up, and you can feel that in a very visceral way. There are moments in retreat that are kind of like that, you know, where you might have that sense of being held up by the air or the light. And of course, that's literally true, though our senses are often not fine enough to be aware of it. But that sense of being buoyed by air, and the light is this kind of waves on the air. And that's fairly rare, you know, maybe a little bit less rare. If you were literally in water, anything else moving in the water, if it were a small enough container, probably even one this big, you'd feel the ripples from it. So you would have this kind of kinetic movement relation to everything that was in the bath or everything that was in the water with you. You'd feel it moving towards you. You could sense the way it's moving. You'd get some sense of its own body and the rhythms of its body by how it moved. And so for me, when I'm in one of those kind of dreamy, somewhat watery spaces, which is also the space of a kind of Sambhogakaya realm of not one, not two, a body of transformations and things sliding in and out of one another and being unstable and metamorphic, those would be two of the things that would happen, that sense of kind of buoyancy, and then even more often, that sense of a kind of dance with all the things that are in the space around me. And often, again, for me anyway, I don't know about you, but in a retreat that's very visceral and very bodily for a lot of the retreat, John Tarrant talks about taking a koan into your body and allowing those sorts of reverberations, and again, sometimes a kind of dreamy way, though sometimes they're very sharp, to happen is an important part of practice for me. Okay, so here comes the poetry part, which you knew was coming, and it's going to be an extended one this time, so I apologize. That the cultural critic Walter Benjamin said he always aspired to write a long book that was nothing but quotation, and he didn't quite get there, and this won't be that, but a lot of it will be just quoting passages of...
Sound check?
Good?
Yes.
Putting passages of poetry for you.
Excuse me, can you speak a bit slowly?
That's hard for me because I'm from New York, but yeah, I'll try. I'll try. Thank you. Yeah. No, I'm sorry, Singh, I will try. So let me offer a kind of rationale, but a little bit of a digression. I remember a long time ago, taking a course on 17th century mannerist and metaphysical poetry, and the teacher, who was pretty smart, said we would spend the first couple weeks of the course actually looking at mannerist paintings. And his idea was that you could sort of see something in the stylization of the painting and the way, you know, things were arranged and the way they were moving, that because it was visual and quite palpable, it would allow you to kind of pick it up in the poetry, that you could hear, not just hear, I don't mean sound, but you could see in the imagery and the metaphor of the poems that it was making the same kind of world. And so the wager here, I don't know if this is right, but my sense is that a lot of the poets I'm interested in are interested in the same kind of space that I'm trying to evoke, and that I think has an important potential relation to Zen practice, at least for some of us. And relatively speaking, the poets are pretty good at putting that sense of space and bodies into words. And so my hope is that if I evoke some of this space for you, that for some of you it might become a little more palpable and a little more available, and so that there'll be little parts of this maybe that will, in some dreamy kind of way, influence some of your practice during the retreat. Another thing I'll say about poems and koans goes by way of one particular koan that I worked on my first retreat many years ago. There's a story, and I don't remember who the teacher is, but there's a story in which a monk is traveling with an older monk who's long, long been awakened. And the monk has this very dramatic awakening. And so he says, everything is so beautiful. And the older teacher, one of those Zen moments, says, yes, yes, but what a pity to say so, which is great. And I realized, walking around in the retreat and being a poetry guy, was intensely moved by this, that the great thing about that is that that story about no words is conveyed to us perfectly in words. And so in some sense, koans tend to be about giving us an evocation of something that can't be said, something that can't logically really be given to us in that way. And I would suggest that poetry often works in the same way.
Would you read the poem again that you just did?
Oh, yeah, it's a koan. There's a monk who's just been awakened. He's traveling with an older monk. And the younger monk says, he's had this big opening. And he says, everything is so beautiful. And the older guy says, the way older guys do in these stories, says, yes, yes, but what a pity to say so. And then the great thing is that that's in words, that it's in a koan that conveys that to us. And so Suzuki Roshi apparently used to say a lot, there's no need to understand my words. And I think the poems I'm going to read say something like the same thing. So you're not really, you know, I'll try to parse a little bit of it if I think there's something really obscure, but I'm trying to give you a series of images that are trying to evoke something that I hope for some of you will be present for some of the retreat. And, you know, pardon the pun, but you could just let them wash over you. If you're a poetry listener who likes to lie down, you know, this would be a lie down night in a kind of dreamy mode. And then I'll just say quickly, and I don't want to make a big deal of this and I won't really come back to it, but of course part of the evocation in the poetry is by means of sound and rhythm. So if you just let the words wash over you, something of the quality of the world and the space that's being evoked ought to be there, even if, this is almost always true on a first reading of something, you don't get all the words. So it should be there in some way for you, I hope. All right. So my main guy for this tonight is not Emily Dickinson, who I hope to return to on Thursday, but Walt Whitman. In Whitman, almost everything, but lots and lots of stuff is liquid or has the quality of being liquid, or the world feels like this kind of ductile flowing of things. A real mythographer himself, there are also lots of moments in the poems where there's a kind of magical, sort of shamanic poet figure whose name just happens to be Walt Whitman, but he's sort of floating around through the world of the poem, and sometimes he'll sort of materialize, or sometimes he'll half materialize, or sometimes he'll be there just as a voice, and sometimes he seems really just to be the space and the atmosphere that we're in. So it reminds me a lot of Hawken, the formless form coming into form and then dissolving again. And his elusiveness tends to create this kind of mobile, sensuous space that, as I said, often has a kind of liquid or ductile feel to it, of things sort of flowing toward other things. And again, I'm not suggesting that you wander around the retreat saying all these things to yourself, but just maybe something of the kind of soft and liquid-like quality of the space will come to you at some moment during the retreat. So at some moments, he really is just the liquid. And here's one of those kind of outlandish, wonderful moments. He says, him they accept. So they accept him, right, the poet. Him they accept, in him lave, the way you'd lave in water, right? In him lave, in him perceive themselves as amid light. So there's this space that's liquid, that's this sort of showering light. And then this wonderful thing, him they immerse, and he immerses them. So that's a little bit like, and I mentioned this in Santa Fe a few years ago, the Maurice Sendak story, Mickey in the Night Kitchen, where the little kid whose mother is pregnant and he's kind of worried about that goes down to the night kitchen and he bakes himself a cake, but he falls into the batter by mistake and he just keeps saying, I'm in the milk and the milk's in me. I'm in the milk and the milk's in me. And we talked about a container some last night. I think one of the remarkable things, and you know, Megan said that it's there so that it can dissolve or something else can happen. One of the remarkable things about Zen container space or Zen images of containers is they're very often reversible. So what was contained becomes the container. It's a little bit like Lingzhi's guest and host trading places. So this kind of magical Sambhogakaya-like space in the inside and outside kind of trade places. This is not in the poem, but I need to mention it because it's related. Another thing I think that happens, and really it's just what Megan said, is that often Zen koans or commentaries will evoke a sense of a container that then just dissolves. And so, you know, we're just in this vastness. And one of the most beautiful ones, I think, is in the Kanseon, the chanted part in the middle that I really love. It's so strange. It says, thought after thought rises in the mind. That's good. I know what to do with that. And then it just says, thought after thought is the mind. So the container disappears and the things that were supposedly contained are just kind of floating in this unbounded space. Anyway, something of that kind of wonky quality of container and contained is present often in Whitman. When he does turn up as the formless form who's just come into form, often it's as if he's suddenly materializing, as if he floated through something kind of liquid to get to you, and he himself is a little bit liquid or elusive. So here's a, I'm glad Ellen's back, because some of this is for you, Ellen. So here's one, all right? This is the press of a bashful hand. The other thing I need to explain, I guess, is if you're listening to the poem, when he says, this is the press of a bashful hand, you're not going to, unless you're extremely susceptible, you're not going to feel the press of the hand, but you might feel like you hear the voice. So in some sense, the presence is there just as this voice that's kind of in your ear. And that feels kind of fluid. Sound feels kind of fluid, as Sarah was saying last night. Anyway, this is the press of a bashful hand. This is the float and odor of hair. This is the touch of my lips to yours. This is the murmur of yearning. And then there's this great moment where he says, as if he's whispering, you know, this hour I tell things in confidence. I might not tell everybody, but I will tell you. And so who did he tell that to?
Everybody.
Yeah, so that's great. That's a really strange sense of spatiality, you know, created just right there. And then Ellen, here's the one for you where it seems that often this kind of buoyant, fluid quality creates a space that's really sort of comically and exuberantly sensuous or eroticized. So here's in old language, buses are not like the guagua that you take to, you know, to go to work, but they're kisses. So buses are kisses when we get to that. There's a wonderful touch of egotism in Whitman too that's worth, as Mary reminded me of a long time ago, is an important part of Zen practice. But anyway, my lovers suffocate me, crowding my lips and thick in the pores of my skin, jostling me through streets and public halls, coming naked to me at night, crying by day, ahoy, from the rocks of the river, swinging and chirping over my head, calling my name from flower beds or vines or tangled underbrush, or while I swim in the bath or drink from the pump, lighting on every moment of my life, bussing my body with soft and balsamic busses, noiselessly passing handfuls out of their hearts and giving them to be mine.
How did you know?
I knew. You know. All right. Okay. So Leaving the poet aside for a moment, often the world itself, the atmosphere, has that similar kind of sensuous or even quasi-sexual quality. And one thing I'd say, I don't want to get into technical stuff here, but there's definitely a quality of something metamorphic in those moments and something kind of polymorphously perverse, that everything is eroticized and takes every possible erotic form in his work. Not everything in Retreat is like that, but sometimes it is. So in this passage, I think what he's describing, though I'm not sure, it's a little hard to tell sometimes, is maybe the air and the sky and the clouds moving around in it, but okay. Hefts of the moving, so note the hefts, that there's something, I'll come back to this later, but he's literally looking at something, but there's something weighty and as if tactile in that moment. So there is that, it has for me some relation to subtle touch and that sense of touch at a distance, you know, that you can register the touch or the feel of something, even if it's not right up against you. And that also does something really strange to the space, which can feel liquid. Anyway, hefts of the moving world at innocent gambols, and that's not like gambling dens, but, you know, gambling, playing. Hefts of the moving world at innocent gambols, silently rising, freshly exuding, scooting obliquely high and low. And if that's just air and clouds, it's pretty mischievous and pretty delicious, you know. And Sarah said last night also that sounds often can materialize that sense of this liquid-like space, and I think that's really important. And they can make us feel either that all of a sudden the medium that the sounds are moving through are kind of viscous and a little bit liquid. And I think, you know, walking every day to work, it doesn't always happen, but if you're a little dreamy, it can feel that way. And that also the sounds can have a kind of liquid quality to them. And here's just one little moment from Whitman about sound. He says, I hear all sounds running together, combined, fused, following. I hear all sounds running together, combined, fused, following. And in that combined, fused, and following, not just in the way the language moves, but there's something about those sounds as already having or conveying some information that feels like movement or something kinetic, that you can feel how something moves by the sound that you receive from it. I should just say I was going to work this into the talk and didn't, but last night was so terrific in so many ways. And the poet Keats apparently used to, like, he lived inland, I guess, but he would sometimes jump up on these hayricks when the wind was blowing, and he would say, the inland sea. And I really had that feeling last night of the air is just these waves kind of rolling across out of the same sound, you know, so that sense of sound is also often ductile or liquid, or is making the air as if liquid. Okay. So it's also worth mentioning, therefore, you guys probably know this, but there are a couple Cohens. There's one in particular where the commentary, and I'm blanking on which one, but it says, oh, and I'll try to get this right, if you can't see with your ear and hear with your eye, you're not yet intimate. And so that's synesthesia, you know, the mingling of the different senses. And if you're used to that as some sort of flamboyant thing in wild poetry that's really pyrotechnical, the Zen thing is very, very different. It's kind of quiet and unobtrusive, but there's this really pervasive mingling of the senses. So when I'm talking here about something like the sound evoking a sense of rhythm or touch, or in a minute things that we see evoking a sense of rhythm or touch, I think that's really right in bed, you know, and bussing its body all together with soft balsamic buses with the Zen tradition. All right. So for me, the kinetic part of that is an important part. All right. So in the space that feels liquid and ductile, it can be a little difficult sometimes, and I know a lot of us have experienced this, to tell inside from outside. I remember one experience I had at a retreat where there was a sound and I couldn't tell if it was the sound in my ear or something outside me, but just that sort of inside body, outside body. And often, you know, the breath can seem like the medium between them. And here's a great passage in Whitman where the space itself feels, again, I think, quietly kind of liquid, ductile, things flow, and there's this kind of loose oscillating movement, if you track it, kind of from interior body sensations and sounds and other things that are coming out from outside, and they're carried by the breath. The other thing I want to mention, it's in a way it's a kind of aside, but one of the really cool things about the passage, and it's hard to pick up on this just by listening, and who cares, but I think you feel the effect of it, there are no verbs in it. I mean, they're verbals, like running or things like that, but it's not a sentence because there are no verbs. And so it really is a moment, you know, where, as Megan and Andrew have both said already, nothing needs to be asserted, nothing needs to be denied, nothing needs to be preferred. There's just this kind of isness rolling through isness, you know, and there isn't a lot that has to be done. So there are no contentions here. This is a little bit longer passage, pretty delicious. The smoke of my own, I want to just point in a pervasive way, though I'll draw your attention to one thing, that the things that are seen or heard have this kind of rhythmic quality that's a little bit like that sort of subtle touch or touch at a distance, that you get a feel for what it would be like to be in intimate and close contact with those things through the other senses. And again, a retreat, I think, is a space where the sensorium gets a little wonky and some of that starts to happen. So, the smoke of my own breath echoes ripples and buzzed whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch and vine, my respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves, and of shore and of the shore and dark colored sea rocks and of hay in the barn, the sound of the belched words of my voice, words loose to the eddies of the wind, a few light kisses, a few embraces, a reaching around of arms, the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag, the delight alone or in the rush of the streets or along the fields and hillsides, the feeling of health, the full noon trill, the song of me rising from bed and meeting the sun. So there's a lot of flowing and blending there that's very beautiful. And I want to draw your attention in a way to the other side of that passage as well. So, you know, Megan talked about a soup where a lot of things swap around and mingle. And it's important that it's not a puree. You know, there's a lot of different stuff in there. So this passage is not the soup of pervading oneness. You know, everything doesn't simply become everything else. So there's that formless form sort of popping or whomping out into form with the poet himself, the feeling of health, the full noon trill, the song of me rising from bed and meeting the sun, and there he is. But there's also this great moment, the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag. And there you're seeing something visually, but there really is, with the supple boughs wag, there really is that sense of registering what it would feel like to have that movement. You get a kind of echo of that movement in your own body. Just parenthetically, I think one of the reasons for that is that it's this weird little metaphor here, because I've never heard somebody literally talk about boughs wagging. So there's this weird little thing about a dog's tail, and there's actually, the motion is quite precise, because, you know, the dog's tail really thickens right before the butt, and so it's a little bit less supple than the rest of the branch, and it's the same thing as the tree branch. So there's a sense of, you know, motions and forms interrelated to one another, and also that as he kind of gets that analogy, there's that movement for him with a special kind of sharpness. So I'm almost done, but I want to move out and I want to get out of the water a little bit and suggest, yeah, Nick. Go.
Could you just read that blip again, that poem
again? Just that the last line, or not the whole thing, right? I'll read it during the
whole thing.
No, we don't have time. We're over already. Okay. So, but the one thing is the play of shine
there isn't
and
any over.
There's
yeah.
No time.
I'll come back. Do you want to hear it again?
Yes.
All right. Here's the whole thing. All right. The whole thing, huh?
Yeah.
All right. The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, and buzzed whispers. Love root, silk thread, crotch and vine. And the crotch, I think, is both, you know, there's a crotch and the tree crotch, you know, so. Right. Love root, silk thread, crotch and vine. My respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves and of the shore and dark-colored sea rocks and of hay in the barn, the sound of the belched words of my voice, words loosed to the eddies of the wind, a few light kisses, a few embraces, a reaching around of arms, but we don't know whose, right, just thing. The play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag, the delight alone or in the rush of the streets or along the fields and hillsides, the feeling of health, the full noon trill, the song of me rising from bed and meeting the sun.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, yeah. So I want to come out of the literal water and suggest that we're kind of, when we're in this kind of sensorium frame or mind frame, that often particular things that we see at a distance or that we hear will have that kind of kinetic or textural quality, as if we felt the heft of them, and there's a kind of bodily registration of them, as if, you know, there can be a sense that for a moment you know what it feels like to move like that, even though you're not that. So it's a really partial thing. And so here's my example. I don't know if you like ballet, but if you go to see ballet and you see Suzanne Farrell dance, who's this marvelous dancer, you can feel those lifts in your own body. But you don't, for a moment, don't think that I'm Suzanne Farrell. You know, so there's something about this body that's not mine, but I just get this inkling, for instance, there it is. You know, there's that, and I wouldn't say Suzanne, I'm you, you know, but there it is. So not one, not two. So sometimes it can be that identification, and sometimes I think it's as if you can feel what it would be like to touch that thing, or it was moving against you or brushing against you. And I think at least that in the physical thing of palpating that doctors do, there's some quality. There's some combination of those two things. They pass over into one another. So if you palpate something, you can feel it against your own hand, but you also were getting a kind of registration of what it is, or and something of that kind of combination of not one, not two, and then of course you're not finally Suzanne Farrell is at work in those moments. So one of the things that's interesting, and it's kind of surprising, but you can be in this very kind of dreamy space and something just, and you know, we know this from the tradition, it just goes pow, you know? And so there's this sense that out of this kind of space in which things are metamorphic, there's one of those kind of hits of a kinetic identification, and you get that thing, again, without thinking it's you, but there it is, you know, it's right, it's intimate, right? So the Tathagata quality of those. So here are a couple in Whitman that are textural and they're not motion. I really love these. He says, where the rattlesnake suns his flabby length on a rock. The flabby's great. The rattlesnake suns his flabby length on a rock. Where the alligator in his tough pimples sleeps by the bayou. And there's something about those plates, you know, that's like that. And here's a motion one. He says, where the geese nip their food with short jerks. And you can get the goose right in that moment. There's a great passage from Keats where it's in his letters. He says, or if a sparrow come before my window, I take part in its existence and pick about the gravel. And I think the logic of it is actually the reverse. It's not like he says, oh, I'm a romantic poet, so I'm supposed to take part in the sparrow's existence. How can I do that? I'll pick about the gravel. But he's looking at that bird, and there's that pick of the gravel, and it's right there for him. It's in his body, you know, in this kind of dream body, and that's taking part in the sparrow's existence, you know. So it's you, and it's not you. I wanted to do one hearing one. I think in retreat, you know, in the hall, we hear a lot of stuff, and that sense that, well, I'll tell you something. I remember saying to, I won't say the whole story, but and we've all had these moments, but just hearing a bird and you get a completely visceral sense that your head is the bird's head for a second. And you know it's not, you know, but there it is. You know, you can feel, and obviously it's wrong, and, you know, the scientist would tell you it's wrong, and the bird would tell you that you got most of it wrong. But there's something that's like, there's the bird. I mean, it's as real to you as you are for yourself for a moment. So here's a hearing one also from Whitman. He's talking about, and so, you know, think about Master Ma and birds going across the sky, right? The wild gander leads his flock through the cool night. Ya honk, he says, and sounds it down to me like an invitation. The pert may suppose it meaningless, but I listen close. Ya honk! There's the goose. There it is. So it's you and it's not you. And I think in moments like this that something magical or transformative potentially happens, and this is also part of the lore of the Zen tradition in a very direct way, I think. Partly, I think it's the quality of not knowing is most intimate. You know, that there's something that's come right into you, but it's still a mystery. It's still like that 8,000-foot cliff. You know that you don't know what it feels like to be a bird, but in some way, for a moment, it's inside you. And maybe it's also that feeling of the categories falling away. You know, the bird is not you and not you, and you're not yourself, but you're not yourself for that moment. And so in those moments, at any rate, I think, and again, this is, I think, right out of the classic tradition, something really big just falls away. And one of the things I love about the Dickinson poem, which I'll try to talk about with you on Thursday, is it's a really small thing. She's just looking at that bird, and the bird does something a little strange, and all of a sudden everything opens up. And I think in those moments, it's very typical that the feeling of this sort of great stillness, that sort of falling right into the Dharmakaya, where there's no difference between motion and stillness, and all things are held in this kind of timeless time, that it's often got that really liquid quality, that sense of being sort of buoyed up in that space. And I'm almost done, but I guess the last thing I want to say is that I've been talking about some fairly extravagant and not so simple feeling kinds of moments. But I guess what I would say is, for me, one of the ways they've been important is that eventually they, you know, after those moments where, oh, you know, I'm floating on the air, they lead to that pretty quiet and simple sense that Andrew evoked last night. You know, just, yeah, I'm already in the bath with everything just as it is, and with everybody just as they are. So that's what's it good for, in some way. So thank you.
Did you hear the first morning the ducks?
I heard crows the second morning.
No, I didn't hear the ducks. Remember, there was like a chorus?
No.
I thought it was frogs, but it was ducks.
Yeah.
Doing exactly
what
you're
talking
about.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks.
And you don't have to apologize for taking...
It's poetry. Of course I have to apologize. The other thing I wanted to say, sort of, I won't do it as an apology, but I meant to say this at the beginning. I think there's a couple things. So one is that people's sensoria work really differently in people's meditation experience. So I don't at all mean this to be prescriptive. You know, it's like, oh shit, I'm having a terrible retreat. I didn't get in a lot of water, you know. If it's not happening, don't worry about it, you know. Probably all to the good. And then the second thing is, I think even if your sensorium does kind of work that way, that poetry is kind of a turnoff for some people, and it's just, you know, it's not a good medium for it, but I hope for some of you it is. So I'd welcome any questions or comments or poems or demurs or anything.
I think every koan is a poem.
Me too.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think every poem is a koan.
Me too.
I was listening to the radio. Was it last week? Was Bloomsbury Day? There's this wonderful little jazz show that I like. And
Pat, I need louder.
I'm sorry. Last week was, I think it was last week, was Bloomsbury Day, one day last week, which is celebrating James.
It was, yeah.
Celebrating James Joyce and Ulysses, that marvelously easy piece of literature. And I was listening to a jazz show, and it's this great jazz show in Santa Fe. And at the end of it, the fellow had about 3 minutes left, and he said, so today's Bloomsbury Day, and I'm going to play for you James Joyce reading Finnegan's Wake, and I don't want you to try and listen to the words, but I want you to listen to it like it's jazz.
Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm.
And it was just... Yeah. I mean, it just came up for me the way you were reading. It is that inside and outside sensation that we get here, especially, you know, in retreat and many other unexpected times. But you know, his marvelous voice, and it was just so beautiful. And it was jazz. It was just great.
That's great. Thank you.
You know this Chinese scientist who studies birds? He slows down the songs, and they're exactly like jazz. They are jazz.
Thank you. Okay, anything else that must be said? Thank you.
I have something to say.
Thank you, too.
Where's that stick?
No, thank you. Andrew.
Well, you know, bringing in the words of the humans playing like this reminded me today, my experience, I was up in the room waiting with the door open, and there's those chickens down here that I could hear them clucking. And I was like, wow, they sound like they're really close, like they come up the hill. I look out the door, and a turkey walked by. So they're playing. Yeah. That was just great. It was, oh, perfect.
Yeah. So that reminds me of the human that Rock was nodding to long before you spoke to it, right? That, yeah. You know, there's all this stuff kind of...
Right,
yeah.
Right.
A wild turkey.
You got Nick, too.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joe.
No, it wasn't one of you all.
Thanks for the clarification.
I just wanted to say thank you for giving voice to something that I've actually never heard voice given to. And I remember years ago saying to two close friends who sit a lot and do retreats a lot, oh, you know that moment where you sort of slip into a crow? And they both looked at me like I was off the wall. Like, no, Nick, that's just you. You know, like it was some really ridiculous thing. But something about the movement in the tree and the sound, the throat, thing has been an element for me, and I've never heard it given any anything other than laughter and ridicule. So, thank you.
So we were separated at birth, then. That's great. Thank you.
I want to echo that, actually. I think you're really giving voice to something that's hard to talk about, and that's really important, and that we need to find ways to talk about. And what was coming up for me as you were talking was throughout the body, hands and eyes.
Mm. What did you say, Megan?
Throughout the body, hands and eyes. Mm. So that's something about that experience of just being right in it,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Can I say just a tiny bit about our shared experience of poetry? That just I was emailing Megan a couple months ago, and she wrote back. So for me, I was doing the poetry before I was doing the Zen. So it's been intertwined with retreats and koans since the beginning. And Megan was saying also that really a lot of the stuff that she came to in Zen was already there for her as an undergraduate and other places, studying poetry. So yeah. And I'll just say a little crazy thing, but when I was working on the Sea of Issei, I kept going back and forth with the Dickinson poem that I read the opening night. I mean, so I sat with that poem for quite a while as a koan. And, you know, I'd already taught it as a poem, but it did some different things as a koan for me.
Would you say that again?
Yeah, there's an Emily Dickinson poem that I read the opening night, The Bird Came Down the Walk, and all of it's really interesting. If we have time to talk about it, my little talk on Thursday morning, I'll bring it in. But the last part, there really is this, you know, the air turns into water in some way. It's just remarkable and so startling and so beautiful. And I was working on, you know, there's a stone at the bottom of the Sea of Issei, 1,000 feet down, right? I want to touch that stone, but I don't want to get my hands wet. And I kept, in retreats, I kept going back and forth between sitting with the Sea of Issei koan and sitting, especially with the end of Dickinson's poem, you know. So what's it like when the air turns into water? What, you know, what are some of the implications of that?
You mean the splashless as they swim?
Yeah, the whole thing, you know. And he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home. Right. That's odd, you know. But then oars divide the ocean, two silver for a seam. I don't want to really get into this now, but it's as if the oars are, the wings are moving through the air, and the idea is that they're moving even softer, well, of course, because it's air, you know, but then oars would divide the ocean, you know, that wake that the, but when the ocean is too silver for a seam. And so the seam would be that silver line that the oars make. And the way I read it anyway, if the ocean is too silver for a seam, it's because it's like sunrise or sunset, and all of the water is glinting. And so all of a sudden there's this sort of marvelous thing that's air, and it's this glinting light at, you know, at the same moment. So he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home than oars divide the ocean, too silver for a seam. And then it keeps opening out and changing, you know, or butterflies off banks of noon. I don't know, banks of flowers at noon, leap splashless as they swim. And there's that, you know, and so in a way you say, oh, it's a joke, you know, haha, it's air, there's no splash. But there is a splash, you know, and in retreat, I mean, I remember a story about one of Suzuki Roshi's students, Graham Peachy, who supposedly sat this 40-day retreat in England, and he said by the end of it, he could hear the bugs walking across the floor behind him, you know. So this is one of those kind of moments, you know, the butterflies leap splashless that you can sort of see. And that's that thing in the Shwedo poem, too, about, you know, he can see the tracks of the birds in the air.
Yeah.
You know, that everything is, you know, it's that kind of zone that you can be in. So
it's also reminding me of Wallace Stevens' Sea Surface Full of Clouds.
Yeah.
Can't hear you.
Wallace Stevens' poem, Sea Surface Full of Clouds. This was also just calling that up for me.
Yeah.
And my entrance was also through poetry. Yeah. I hadn't made that connection, yeah. But a summer class on Whitman and Melville.
Yeah, great.
Just the whole class was just Whitman and Melville.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that's going through my mind is, Tanny, and hearing the beautiful way that you've selected this poetry to offer these, not metaphorical really, but concrete instances of interpenetration of consciousness and existences across beings, and that's what Joan used to do with mythology. You know, she was so well steeped in mythology, and Megan and Andrew, you guys did the same thing, and it was really the same kind of topic. This interpenetration, this cauldron full of interpenetrating beings, some of whom live inside here, and some of whom are the other 15 bodhisattvas out there, but they're all interwoven and you know, stewed into this unique combination synergy beyond, you know, the components of each one. But you also brought in like a cheesy TV show. What was it called? The Young Ones. And
cheesy.
And Megan, you brought in some mythology and referenced Wicca and those kinds of things. So I'm thinking, what is the open source? This is one thing that's on my mind this week.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
And I think that this, you know, I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about the same thing. He talks about interbeing and interpenetration, and but in a different way, in a way that is not so full of very concrete imagery drawn from a range of other traditions and other disciplines, other sources of knowledge. And this may be an attribute of our way of inquiry.
Yeah. Joan says someplace. Thank you very much. Joan says someplace that. You know, given the fact that she talks about having a really big opening, listening to a commercial for the TV show Dallas while driving on the radio, that we're not a school that's snobbish about what leads to awakening.
Right.
David, I think that's true about open source, which is what does not attract me about many other more formal sanghas,
mm-hmm.
that we are... we're a literary sangha, for one thing. We have a wide knowledge of poetry and Shakespeare, and it just always comes up sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
So, and mythology, and, you know, Joan's poetic sensibility. Tenny too. So I think that to me is one of the most attractive qualities. Because it's not just Zen. Or it's not Zen. You know what I mean?
Well, the koans absolutely invite this, this broad-ranging inquiry.
Yeah, as they should. I don't know if I should mention this, but many years ago when I was dating my husband-to-be, he lived in Seagate in Brooklyn, and he would never kill an insect. So he had cockroach colonies. And he swore that he knew each one individually. And he tended to them like that. That's sort of an example of what you're talking about.
And this was not a red flag about
you. That's either a great Zen story or just a story about guys from Brooklyn, you know.
Either you're a bunch of turkeys or a bunch of cockroaches.
It didn't last long, David.
Did you have to make it us or it's them or me?
It never was with him.
So it's not Zen, and it's not not Zen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it's a true Zen.
What?
Zen, maybe it's a true Zen.
A true Zen, that's right.
But it's a pity to say so.
I don't care.
That's right.
Was it Whitman who said, "I'm large, I contain
the
Yeah. That's right.
I got to say one thing, though. He was funny, too. And so sometimes like that thing of, like, I can take everything into me didn't work out right. And so there's a passage where he says, I am stuccoed with quadrupeds and birds all over, which is like Roadrunner, you know. It's like all this stuff sort of slammed into his body and wouldn't go in. You know? So that's important to remember, too. I think. Yeah.
So, Tinny, if there was one Walt Whitman book to purchase and carry with us.
Yeah. He kept rewriting this thing that he called Leaves of Grass. Uh-huh. But the best one, the first edition, is the 1855 edition, which you can get in, like, you know, really cheap online versions or paperback. So, and I'll say one other thing. So the Ezra Pound, the great modernist poet, it's really nasty, but it turns out it's true. He says some, I shouldn't say this having read all this, but he says some, I always knew there were 20 good pages in all of Whitman, and then he said, I went back to reread them, and I realized I couldn't realize which ones they were.
Yeah.
And there's this thing about Whitman that there's this odd mix of being just brilliant, you know, and then sort of programmatic and tedious. So one of the things is that there are passages where he's got to prove to you that he can identify with everything in the world. But it's clear that, unlike the passages I read, he kind of hasn't really thought about it. So I'm one with this, I'm one with that. And the older he got, the more that tended to happen. But the best stuff is, you know, such an influence on almost everybody who comes after, and so marvelous, you know.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And how about Emily Dickinson?
The thing there is, like, I mean, again, there's like a collected poems, and there's a thing called Final Harvest, which is a big selected. But the thing about her is it's almost all great. You know, it's not like Whitman, you know.
Right.
You know, it's just, there's almost nothing you can read that's like startling.
But with Whitman, don't you think sometimes that you have to read some of the bad stuff in order to really, I think you have to take it all in.
Yeah.
And that's why you can't identify the 20 pages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my teacher, Kenneth Koch, the poet, used to say, it seemed like mean advice, said, if Whitman's getting boring, it means you have to slow down.
Yeah.
But then he said, which I really love, he said he loved reading Whitman out loud because you felt like you had rocks in your mouth. And there's something about that sort of clunky, grainy language that's, you know, part of what I hope you heard. And that's the Tathagata thing, too, you know, womp, you know, just in the graininess of the words.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a little bit like the sutras where... Some of the sutras where you go, why are they going on and on and on about this? Mm-hmm. Until you read it out loud, repeatedly.
Yeah.
And something happens.
Yeah.
And something that I'm really feeling in these poets and the sutras too is that we need to be able to feel grandiose. We need to give ourselves permission to be that big, to feel that big, to really allow for that experience.
That's great.
And to not
judge it, to not close it down. That's what they were able to do, was to really be able to allow for something very big. And I think that, I know in myself there's a tendency to not want to allow for that.
Yeah, that's great, thank you.
That is great, I like that, like Wordsworth.
Yeah.
So Vimalakirti puts 35,000 people in his
right.
parlor.
Yeah. When I have any sense of that, I call myself narcissistic.
Right, but that's not.
It's not
different.
That. It's not because it's not about me.
Right.
It's about allowing that much largeness.
Yeah.
Allowing things to get that big.
And God forbid you do it if you're a woman.
Right. Right, there are many voices that don't allow for this, and these poets are so amazing because they show us that it's possible.
That's great. Yeah, that's great.
Have you read any poems in different language that you don't know?
I listened to them, yeah. Yeah.
And what did you get?
I got a lot of good sounds, you know. Yeah, but I mean, it evokes something, right? I mean, there's a quality, you know, to the world and what's evoked, you know.
Can you say it again?
There's a quality to, I mean, it evokes a certain kind of world, you know. I also love, I mean, it's been a while since I've read Spanish poetry, but I mean, there's that really unabashed largeness, you know. It's just, you know, all the time, you know.
Cesar Vallejo.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking about Lorca too, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know Jerome Bernstein's work on the borderland personality?
No.
Well, you might be interested, because he's talking about what you're talking about.
Thank you. I'll catch you later, okay?
He's a Jungian analyst.
Thank you. So if there's nothing else, the thing about the permission for the largeness seems like a really good place to leave it for now. So thank you very much.
We'll restore the hall.